good evening. What motivates terrorism and the lost bird of the Wounded Knee Massacre? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Friday, December 27th, 2019. The United Nations said 235,000 civilians had fled their homes in rebel-held northwestern Syria during a Russian-backed campaign of airstrikes and shelling this month. Moscow and Damascus deny claims of indiscriminate bombing of civilians, saying that they were fighting jihadist militants. Witnesses say hostilities have left many towns in ruins and knocked out dozens of medical centers. President Donald Trump has spoken out against what he calls the carnage involving thousands of civilians in Syria. The Russian and Syrian advance toward Idlib is also putting pressure on Turkey. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan said his country cannot handle a fresh wave of migrants from Syria, warning that Europe will feel the impact of such an influx if the bombing is not stopped. And the Philippines has banned two U.S. lawmakers from visiting and will introduce tighter entry restrictions for U.S. citizens should Washington enforce sanctions over the detention of a top government critic. President Rodrigo Duterte says he'll impose visa requirements on U.S. nationals should any Philippine officials involved in the incarceration of Senator Leyla de Lima be denied entry to the United States. That's being sought by Senators Richard Durbin and Patrick Leahy. De Lima, a justice minister and a former administration, has called for an international investigation into Duterte's war on drugs, in which thousands of people have been killed. And the FBI is investigating British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell and several other people linked to U.S. financier Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. Sources tell Reuters a principal focus of the FBI's investigation is Maxwell, a longtime associate of Epstein, and other people who facilitated Epstein's alleged illegal behavior. Maxwell has not been accused of criminal wrongdoing. Maxwell, the daughter of late British media magnate Robert Maxwell, is an ex-girlfriend of Epstein who remained a member of his inner circle. She has largely disappeared from public view since 2016. Virginia Jeffrey, one of Epstein's alleged victims, has said in a civil lawsuit that Maxwell recruited her into Epstein's circle, where she claims Epstein forced her to have sex with him and friends, including Prince Andrew of England. Maxwell has called Jeffrey's allegations lies. Iraqi President Bahram Saleh has refused to designate the nominee of an Iran-backed parliamentary bloc for prime minister. He says he'd rather resign than appoint someone to the position who would be rejected by protesters. The Iranian-backed Bina bloc, the largest in Iraq's parliament, had nominated Basra governor Assad al-Idani to be the next prime minister. Mass demonstrations have gripped Iraq since October 1st, and protesters, most of them young, are demanding an overhaul of a political system they see as profoundly corrupt and keeping most Iraqis in poverty. More than 450 people have been killed. And in New York, a U.S. federal appeals court on Friday ordered the resentencing of a Staten Island, New York man for attempting to provide material support to Islamic State and kill an FBI agent, saying his 17-year prison term was, quote, shockingly low. The second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan said Fareed Mumuni's trial judge abused her discretion in imposing a term that was 80% below the 85 years recommended by federal guidelines, and even below the 18-year term for co-defendant Munther Omar Saleh, who was not accused of attempted murder. Mumuni, 25, was convicted of attempting to kill an FBI agent in June 2015 by stabbing him repeatedly with an 8-inch kitchen knife. Prosecutors said Mumuni pledged allegiance to Islamic State and tried to raise money to travel to areas it controlled and had received permission from an attack facilitator, that's in quotes, for the group to use a pressure cooker bomb against law enforcement officers. Peace activist Kathy Kelly is co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's traveled many times to Iraq and to the Middle East. She says the rage of people who target America may have its roots in the way the U.S. has treated nations like Afghanistan and Iraq since the first Gulf War.
We only think about the bombings, which were horrible, shocking and awful, but also hundreds of thousands of children couldn't survive because they couldn't get the most basic of medicines. They couldn't get antibiotics. If they did undergo surgery, they couldn't get anesthetics. I mean, it was torture and it was agony. And people wouldn't carry those babies off to cemeteries and just say, oh, well, you know, that was a bad day. And then we also have to think about the torture that went on. You know, Abu Ghraib was the one prison that sort of went into people's lore, I think, because it was just so ghastly to have these pictures mocking frightened and badly abused prisoners. But I had gone to another camp, and it was also a prison where Abu Ali Baghdadi had been detained, and he was held by the United States for a year. And in that year's time, the humiliations and abuses that we heard about when we visited that prison, I'm sure would have fed the desire of many, many people to extract revenge. The teenagers that I had gone to visit, who happened to be Palestinians, they were studying in medical and engineering schools, and they got picked up immediately when the Marines arrived in Baghdad. You know, they would tell us that they were paraded naked in front of women military soldiers. They had to hold up their bowls and bark like dogs or say, I love George Bush, sometimes just to get food. It was a tent camp, and it was the most miserable place I've ever seen. And I've seen some pretty awful refugee camps, but this was a matter of people sleeping on the ground where they could be bitten by desert scorpions. They weren't given decent blankets when the desert nights were cold. And there were abuses of some 13-year-olds who landed there. And the young ones that I was talking to said, you know, we were trying to tell the guards, you've got to do something. They would just laugh and walk away. And this camp was called Camp Buka. It was named after Joe Buka, a firefighter who tragically lost his life on September 11th in 2001. And certainly he should be remembered. But it was as though the Americans were saying, well, we have to extract revenge for what happened, even though there was no way to attribute the blame to Iraqi civilians.
Iraq had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, yet whenever you bring up the kind of logic that you're bringing up now, you, especially in those days, you would get this response, how dare you say what we did? They attacked us.
Well, there were some very brave New Yorkers, primarily, who basically said, look, our grief is not a cry for war. And a number of us, right, well, I mean, I was in New York City on 9/11. We were doing a fast. We were intending to fast for 40 days. And I think we were on day 34 or something, calling for an end to the economic sanctions. And so we just decided that we'd engage in silence for a few days. And then one of our number, Ramzi Khaisia, said, we have to raise our voices again because there are other voices that are going to be drowned out, and those are the voices of people we know in Iraq. So we decided to take those statements of New Yorkers who had said, yes, my loved one was killed, but I'm not calling for war. People like Rita Lazar and Colleen Kelly and David Petorti, and we just held their statements up and walked from the Pentagon to New York City. But eventually, these others who made those statements joined us, and it was really quite it was like a retreat on the road, and people shared their stories with one another and still now continue an organization called Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And I think there are many people, when they just get a little bit better understanding, they won't maintain the U.S. foreign policy that's been based on threat and force and bombing and killing and night raids and torture and displacement. But the military, which gets this huge budget, $738 billion again this year, they can pay lobbying firms, PR firms, they can buy off media places. And so it's an educational task when the military has a vice-like grip on education in our country.
What do we take away from this, what you're saying?
We are responsible. We are responsible for what's happened in Iraq and what's happening in Afghanistan. And we will have a far better future if we do the simple act of saying, we're sorry, we're so very sorry, and then extend the hand of friendship, not to meddle in other people's affairs of reconstruction. That hasn't gone very well at all. But I think to extend the hand of friendship and try to find out how we could pay reparations without worsening the situation. And if people think, oh, where are we going to get the money to do it? Take it away from the military, and there will be plenty.
peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. This weekend is the 129th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Massacre. Approximately 300 men, women, and children of the Lakota Indian Nation were killed, and 51 were wounded, 4 men and 47 women and children, some of whom died later. 25 soldiers also died, and 39 were wounded, 6 of the wounded later died. Little known is that the soldiers were part of the 7th Cavalry, which had years before been the same group of soldiers massacred by Native Americans at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. That was during an attack into the region led by a general by the name of Custer. A little known story about Wounded Knee is that of the four-month-old baby girl who survived the massacre and a night in sub-zero temperatures before being discovered underneath the body of her mother the next day. The baby girl, named Zintkala Nuni, in Lakota meaning lost bird, was eventually raised by suffragette and early feminist editor Clara Colby, a close associate of Susan B. Anthony, whose husband was a soldier and seized the baby as a war prize. After a difficult life, the child, lost bird, died at the age of 30 in Southern California. Renee Flood is author of the book Lost Bird of Wounded Knee.
You pronounce her name Zintkala Nuni, and it's called Lost Bird. And she was a Lakota Sioux child who was a four-month-old infant when she was found alive among the victims at the Wounded Knee Massacre between the tribe, the Lakota, and the United States officers. You know, it's such a sad story because someone that's out of their league, out of their, you know, somebody from another country would come to the United States and then all of a sudden become a celebrity just because you're alive, you know. And she was so young, and people would fondle her and touch her dress, and she didn't really know who she was. She'd run away all the time, and she couldn't make her white mother happy at all. Her mother was embarrassed when all this happened.
She died very young, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She had a boyfriend, I think, and didn't last long, but she couldn't communicate with white people. She'd never been around Indian people, but even that, she tried to be white. Her mother kept telling her, this is the way we do things because we're white. Well, she's not white. In fact, she was very dark. She always felt that she was less of a person because of her skin color and because of what had happened to her. It just captured me. I felt so sorry for her, and I went up to her grave. I'll start crying. But it made me feel so bad to see her there. Mm-hmm. So we took her, and the people at Wounded Knee took her, and, you know, I knew her story, and I'm sorry I'm crying, but it's a sad story. And she never did find any happiness. That's the sad part. She never found herself. She tried to be white. She tried to be Indian. She tried to be what other people wanted her to be, but she never made it. And she never could make her mother understand or be proud of her because she always had to dress white. And then everybody would say, this is the girl, and they put her up on the stage or wherever they were. And especially the women who should have known, who were in the women's movement at that time, Susan B. Anthony, they treated her terribly. They couldn't stand the child because she couldn't sit still. You know, she wanted to run around and look outside and everything. And they also made her feel badly. And it was sad because she couldn't be who everybody wanted her to be. She couldn't be white. She couldn't be all Indian. She couldn't do things. And some of the Indian people also tried to help her. Many tried to help her take her in and teach her things and stuff. And then her father would be furious when he would find that out, and he would come after her. And she ran away back to the tribes several times and was beaten and run back and beaten, you know, for having run away.
What should we take away from this?
I think we should let people be who they are. You know, whether they're white or black or Indian or whatever they are, there's beauty in every type of religion and every type of people on earth. And we should have more tolerance of how they are. And they feel just like we feel. They're victims just like we are victims. They've been through tragedy just like we have. I used to go back every year, and always on horseback. The people at Wounded Knee, they go back every year on horseback up to her grave, and they pray for her. And it seems to help. The prayers seem to help all of us. Her story is important. There's someone always at her grave, even in the wintertime, and they sit around her grave, and when I go up, I find flowers all around her and things that they've left, little things that their children have left for her, little toys, and it shows how much they love her, even though she's gone. They still loved her. Her own people loved her. And I wish she knew. Maybe she does. I don't know. But it was a sad story, and it took me a long time, and I don't know how many years it took me, but I had to finish it, you know, to show there's many lost birds around the world. In all those cowboy Indian fights and everything, there was always dead babies or babies that were half dead left on the ground, and it was a miracle that she lived. So you can't imagine what kind of a fight this was. This was a huge fight with, you know, just lots of soldiers and Indians, and she lived, and she lived, and now she's an example of strength. Be who you are. Be proud of who you are. No matter what color your skin is, it doesn't matter what your skin is. If you're a good person and you help people, what difference does it make what color you are, or, you know, how you dress or whatever? Her mother wanted her always to dress in white clothing. She never felt comfortable.
Renee Flood is author of Lost Bird of Wounded Knee. The massacre at Wounded Knee happened on December 29th, 1890, in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Over 300 Lakota people, men, women, and children, were killed. Sitting Bull, a noted elder of Lakota people, had been assassinated by an Indian police officer at his home several days earlier. And you're listening to the WBAI News. In sad news, a noted Broadway composer, Jerry Herman, lyricist who gave America the rousing old-fashioned musical Hello, Dolly and Mame in the 1960s, and Broadway's first musical featuring gay lovers, Lacage au Folle. I don't know how to say that, but I'll just say I've seen the movie before, The Birdcage, and it's beautiful. In the 1980s, this died on Thursday in Miami. He was 88. Herman wrote music that left the nation singing, rich melodies with powerful lyrics that stopped shows, dazzled critics, kept audiences returning for more, and paved Broadway with gold for producers and performers. To millions, he was the post-war theater's clearest successor to Irving Berlin, a throwback to an era of songwriters who touched the heart with sophisticated simplicity and bringing audiences to their feet at the curtain calls and sending them home humming the unforgettable tune, Hello, Dolly.
Well, hello.
Look who's here.
Dolly, this is Louis.
Hello, Louis.
Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong.
I am so glad to be back.
Are you looking swell?
Thank you, Louis.
Dolly, I can tell.
Does it show?
Dolly, you still glowing, you still crowing, you still...
Going strong,
I feel the room
sway,
and the band play one of our favorite songs.
Remember, remember it,
so
it was my favorite.
Show some snap, fellas, find an empty lover.
And that's some of the news for Friday, December 27th, 2019. The news is engineered by Reggie Johnson. for the WBAI listeners-sponsored, locally produced, and independent news. I'm Paul D'Arienzo.